Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is 6:02 on Monday, the 17th of May, 2021, and this is the regular Kiri Beach Town Council meeting. First thing we will do is we'll have an invocation and pledge to allegiance. John, do you have an invocation?
Sure.
Please.
Everyone would please bow their heads. Holy One, known by many names and beyond all names, Spirit of life, Spirit of love, Spirit of community, Spirit of justice, we ask your blessings on the people who have been called to lead this community in which we live and work and play. Help us as leaders to not ask first, how do we fix this, but what do we need to learn? How might we need to change? And to whom do we need to listen? Remind us, because we all forget from time to time, especially in the noisiness of what passes for political debate today, that we are not only leaders but also servants. And that it is our responsibility to serve the common good for all. Grant us the wisdom and courage to know and to do what is right and good and true. May we speak out when it is time to speak out, and listen patiently and receptively when it is time to listen. May we always be guided by the spirit of community, the spirit of justice, the spirit of love. This we pray in the name of all that we hold sacred and holy, and that we hold good and right and true. Amen.
Amen. Stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, gentlemen of the council, we have a consent agenda items listed before you. Do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda or any recommended changes?
Motion to approve consent agenda items.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Then we have the adoption of the general agenda. Any recommended changes to this agenda, or do we go ahead and move to approve?
Mr. Mayor, under new business, I don't think I'm the one to report on this. 10.1. I don't know who he is, but that wasn't one of my items.
Okay, so you want to take something off of there?
I don't know who's supposed to present it. I don't. Well.
Okay, I would need a motion for the change.
I'll make a motion.
Yeah.
It's actually dated. Isn't it?
Sorry. So put me on for that one. We do want to approve the mitigation plan update from the region. They've asked us to do that, so put my name on there for that one.
Okay.
Because I'm the number, new business 10.1 with Hagler versus Dock.
Second.
Okay. Then let's have a motion to accept.
I'm on the screen.
David made the motion. Alan seconded.
Second.
Oh. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to make a little bit of a statement. We have a lot to do this evening. We have to get through the budget to be prepared so that we can approve that shortly. We have to go through Chapter 12 in the planning and zoning, which is going to take some significant time. We're going to look at a couple other things here. I would ask that we proceed at the right level of required information. So let's go. Let's start with public comment. Do we have anyone signed up for public comment or anybody dialed in?
Nobody signed up here, just committee members and presentations.
Okay. Anybody
and
on?
I have six on the call.
Okay, so there's six on the line, but do we have questions? Okay. All right, then we'll move into the presentations. The first presentation is Mr. David Parker, safety officer from Cape Fear Salem Power Squadron. Welcome to Curry Beach, sir.
Thank you, sir. I am a resident of Curry Beach, which I'm very proud of. I'm a fairly new resident.
Good.
Because he helped me a lot. My name is Otis White. I'm commander of the Cape Fear Salem Power Squadron. This is David Parker.
I'm David Parker.
And he's the executive officer of the Cape Fear Salem Power Squadron. And this is Lieutenant Barbara White, who is our staff photographer. Thank you. Saw someone white. Mm-hmm. Mr. Mayor, Council, it is a real pleasure to be in front of you tonight and talk about safe boating and safe boating issues. Last year, 2020, a year that you would think there were no boat sales, it was singularly the largest sales year for new boats in 13 years. The number of people on the water in brand new boats, they have no idea how to run, has grown just incredibly over the last year. Part of our goals as an organization, and we ask you each year for the proclamations, and thank you for doing that for us each year, mm-hmm. is to bring education and knowledge to the public about what safe boating is all about and prevent deaths and injuries here on our waters. To me, Pleasure Island is a special place, and we have a huge number of boats in the waters around here as well as in the marinas that are here. And I wanted to go over a couple of figures with you and share some information, particularly about wearing life jackets. That's why we all have our life jackets on. We don't generally wear them in the car, although that might not be a bad idea. On average, 613 people die in the United States each year in boating-related accidents. 80% of those accidents are drownings. 80% are drownings. Of the drownings that happen, most of the folks, 86%, were not wearing life vests. They did not have the proper safety equipment to be doing what they were doing out there on the water. These come in many different styles. This is my fishing vest. It's light, even on a hot summer day, it's cool, doesn't get in my way. That's all I want. David's wearing one that's a little more substantial. If he's in rough weather, he can put that one on. May 22nd to the 28th is National Safe Boating Week. And we'd like to invite all of you to spend some time that week and think about safe boating and what it is to do safe boating. And secondly, our organization offers to anyone for free the Coast Guard Vessel Safety Examination, where you can get your Coast Guard sticker that you put on the side of your boat and let the Coast Guard know that you have all the proper, legally required state and federal safety equipment on your boat. And we are more than happy to come to you, meet you at the marina, meet you at the boat launch, meet you at your house, and give you a vessel safety inspection to help you have the right equipment to save your life. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to them.
Thank you very much. What you do is quite important.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, gentlemen, do you wish to approve the proclamation of the National Safe Boating Week?
Yes. I'll make a motion to that.
Okay. Hey, John.
Okay, John. Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye, Dave Redwood.
Okay, you got it. Thank you very much for what you do. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have New Shore Beach Mitigation Solution. Mr. Harrington from New Shore. Is Mr. Harrington here? Is Mr. Harrington on the phone? Well, then I guess we are going to make up some time. We will move to committee business.
I apologize for Mr. Harrington. He even sent in a new...
Well, we have the presentation. I mean, we can go through it and discuss it at some point in time.
Yeah. We'll join again next month.
Bike Ped Advisory Committee. Good evening, Mo.
Good evening. I was going to tell you three things, but I can cut it to two. Then you're going to wonder what the third thing was, right? But the first thing, which is the most exciting thing, is we met with Jason from altago.com. If you go to the website, altago.com, you will be able to look at the work that they've done before. So it was Nikki and Sean and Alan from town, myself, Abby from WMPO, a GIS guy, which I guess that means he does the maps, somebody from NCDOT, and Jason. Jason will be our representative that will help the town, and he will meet with Sean and come down. We looked at the town via Google Earth and pointed out places like Kay and Fort Fisher that really need help. And so he will do some preliminary stuff, and then he will plan a charrette and come down for several days. And at that time, we will get the public involved or any interested party involved in looking at all the different ideas we can come up with to make our town a safer place for all travelers, people walking, people on bicycles, kids with surfboards, and the time frame sounded like early summer because the WMPO money comes available June or July 1st, and then it has to be completed within a year. And I think they talked about maybe it would be a three-month process or so. So everybody was really excited after we had this first introductory meeting, and we are on track, and we've got momentum. So that was number one.
Okay.
Number two is thanks to our town attorney who completed a waiver to get us off the hook for, you know, any unfortunate things that might happen. We actually have two people signed up and the waiver is in. I'm hoping our town will get at least 20. Because 20 at $40 a person would raise $800 for Cape Fear cyclists, which then they shuffle a lot of that money over to the Terry Denji Bicycling Foundation, which ends up providing free helmets for kids, pays for safety education, the money goes towards scholarships or grants for local charities. And I fully intend on getting some of that money back next year at our festival in 2022 with a safety education event. So that's number one and number two.
So do we have two people signed up, or?
We have two people signed up with waivers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so more people are actually signed up, but we have to get their waivers back. And there was a little bit of technical difficulties. So we're ironing that out. So if people want to print the waiver out from the website, they can. And then they can scan it and fax it back to the kbbikepedcommittee.com at gmail.com. Or We're going to have them already printed out here in town. They can come to town, pick up a waiver, sign it, leave it here, put it in an envelope, put it in the lockbox, but they just have to alert us at our committee email address that they want in, and I think that's it.
Okay. How many bikers do we have signed up so far? Non-waivered bikes.
Five.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I've had a lot more people say to me, my husband and I are going to sign up.
I got two in my house that hadn't signed up yet.
Curry Beach, we can do better.
We'll put it out on Sound News again.
Okay. Well, and I did actually print up our notice. And I didn't know if I could put this like up at the post office or something like that. Is that allowable?
If they have a public board, you certainly can.
Okay.
We have a public board at the oceanfront.
We do have the oceanfront as well.
Okay, and I can just get in there and stick it in.
Is that a locked glass, Mandy?
The town will.
At oceanfront?
The town will put it out there.
Yeah.
Okay, so to get it at the oceanfront part,
town will do that.
Do I give this to you?
I'll print them.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Do you have any blank waivers with you?
No, but actually at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, Mickey will have some printed, and they will be here for pickup.
We can have them here at Town Hall available. They're here available at Town Hall for people that come in. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks, Mom.
You're welcome. Thank
Good
you.
News. Community Center Committee. Community Center Committee had lost quite a few of its members over the COVID period. We have three new applicants, which would take that committee to 7, I believe. So there's a meeting next month where the applicants will attend and meet the rest of the committee and proceed. So good progress there as we start that very, very good and useful committee back up. Historical Preservation Committee? Commission, sorry.
I'll take that, Mayor.
All right.
Chairman Goldberg had a conflict, couldn't be here tonight. At the last meeting, we continued to look at the design standards and the examples of minor work therein to more clearly make the point that ordinary repair and maintenance that doesn't result in changes are not subject to the historic district regulations. Chairman Goldberg also focused on two other things. He raised some suggestions about procedural aspects of agendas and the like, and those will be addressed in time. He also recommended adopting the rules, Robert's Rules of Order, and personally, I think that's a great suggestion for not only PZC, but HPC, PZC, and BOA, and will, in short order, will bring amendments to those rules of procedure, providing for the adoption of those rules to council for approval. And that's about it.
Okay.
And we're still searching for new members. We just had still one applicant.
Yeah, I sent it out on Thursday, and I haven't received any other ones. So I'll keep sending it out monthly.
Is that the business applicant you're talking about?
No.
Okay. All right. We have a business applicant?
Hopefully.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Land Use Plan Committee.
We are still waiting for the survey results, which I think the last communication we received from Wes was we had 792 responses. We were hoping for a total of 500, so we are well ahead of the game. And we will meet June 7th, right? Monday, June 7th. And that'll be our first official meeting when we'll start going into the existing land use plan and then begin narrowing down the survey responses and tailoring them to what people stated it's back.
It's the 8th at 10. Sorry.
Oh, the 8th, sorry, is off a day.
Okay.
But yeah, we're moving forward slowly.
So the committee is doing the tabulation?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Progress there. Marketing committee.
We still have not had a Cure Beach marketing committee meeting this calendar year. And the president or the chairman of that committee has recently sold her house, Ms. Elliott, and they are moving over to Brunswick County. Closing is this week, so we're in search of a new member, and of those people that are on the committee, the next time we meet, we'll have to elect a new chairman.
Yeah, I think, John, you might need to call that committee together and encourage them to pick a leader. The TDA will be putting out their budget, which will identify what type of marketing campaign they wish to use, and we need to have an active committee to participate in that. So
that's also a public meeting, so we need to advertise it. So we need at least 7 days. And also, Ms. Elliott had emailed us about presenting at the June meeting, but if she's not a resident or whatever, and she's not going to be presenting, then we need to know who's going to.
Okay.
Parking committee. Parking committee is really not meeting at this point in time because we are in fact parking and paying for parking. We have an idea of where we sit financially, and we have an excellent start. We don't have the official reports. They lag Arlen by about 4 weeks, something like that. So given that we are in this approximately now 1 month or so, we will shortly have some information that will be public information on how we are doing officially. Do you want to add anything to that, Joseph?
I may end up being wrong about what I thought about parking. That's all I'll say. So,
you have any other thoughts, Arlen?
I think hopefully within the next 2 weeks we'll get that first report. Okay. With all the different revenue and expenditure information.
Mr. Panicali, you're on the parking committee. Any feedback or anything you've heard?
No, not for me, Mayor.
Okay. All right, we'll move on. But that is happening. Planning and Zoning Commission, Chapter 160, Update and Review. Counselor.
Thank you, Mayor. The bad news is we've got over 100 pages of proposed text amendments, but the good news is my presentation is going to be actually very brief.
Good.
So I'm going to utilize the first link there, the presentation document, as part of my presentation. Some of this may be a little redundant, but 160D was a legislative enactment that completely rewrote land use planning and development statutory provisions. It didn't result in hardly any substantive changes, but it did do a lot of other things, and that's one of the reasons why I can be brief. We're just going to get to the bottom line of what 160D does. And it does impact everything. It impacts me legally, it impacts staff, it impacts you all. But the good news is, it doesn't change what we've been doing. It consolidates it, it unifies it, it reorganizes it, and it fills in gaps. Got somebody coming in? For example, the changes to 160D resulted in making changes to chapters 2, 11, 13, 14, and 15 of the code. But a lot of those changes are stylistic. Also, for example, we took PZC out of chapter 2, and we took BOA out of chapter 15, and combine them with HPC in the new Chapter 12. So that's kind of the idea of how this is reorganizing everything, and we'll see more of that as we get into it. I'm not going to go through 2, 11, 13, 14, and 15. 2 is, again, what we did was move PCC over into the land use development section of the code, Chapter 12. Chapter 13 is storm, part of it is stormwater, and John was kind enough to provide me with some model language. All that that change does was to point to 160D as the legal source instead of 160A. Literally, that's all that it did. Chapter 11, your old code, that's unsafe buildings and minimum housing code. Everything that you needed was there, but there was some ambiguity, some confusion, and one or two little gaps which were important to fill in because that chapter is all about due process. You got to jump through a lot of hoops and you got to jump through them correctly. Fortunately, John and I have been, and Bethany, have been working that chapter on a local matter just about the same time that I went through 160D. So a lot of that is stylistic and we filled in the gaps. 14 subdivision regulation, hardly any changes were necessary to the existing chapter. 15 zoning did have some changes, but not as much as you might think, and I'm going to sum them up real quickly. We moved BOA and PZC and combined with HPC in Chapter 15. As a matter of fact, we're going to look at 15 real quickly because I didn't want to point out one thing. I'm waiting on iCompass to download it. Is that normal?
I think it's because you were getting another thing, so maybe just go back and then try again.
Yeah, looks like it's coming up. Let's try one more time, otherwise I'll just... I'm not sure what that's all about. I hope it gets me back to my presentation time. The two changes that we did to 15 was we laid out Board of Adjustment, PZC, and Historic Preservation Commission. And it's almost like setting up their charter. We talked about the members, the qualifications, we talked about powers and duties, processes and procedures. And I just refer to your, for your own reading pleasure, there's a lot of stuff in there that was, I've been PZC's attorney since 2014. And it was very interesting to reread some of the things that it has the authority to do in the code. It was a refreshing matter. We also, the other main, then we did two other things to 15. Even though you have just approved the Historic Preservation Commission regulations, I rewrote those, but only stylistically. What do I mean by that? When you all had those text amendments before, I would, an example would be that I called Historic Preservation Commission, I abbreviated to HPC. But in all my other 160D stylistic changes, I actually went back to quoting the name of, putting forth the entire name. So one of the changes that I made in rewriting that section of 15 was Historic Preservation Commission instead of HPC, so it's all stylistic. The main change to 15 was with the what is currently the special use permit section, which I think is 1508-080. That laid out several pages of what council does when a special use, it lays out everything you need to know about special use permits. And that's fine. But Chapter 160D treated it a little differently. They had a section called quasi-judicial zoning decisions. And that allowed me to address in one section of Chapter 15 not only council's special use permit considerations, because that's quasi-judicial, but COA, certificates of appropriateness for major work in the historic district, and also BOA. All three of those bodies make quasi-judicial decisions. So following the 160D approach, just because I changed the screen. See, okay. it still won't let me have a 15.
Okay, I'll put it up.
You gonna pull it up?
Yes.
Yeah, if you do, well, so do I need to stop?
I think it's because it may be large. It is. It's a large document.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I got you.
So am I gonna have to re-mirror in a minute?
Yes.
If you could go to 1580080. A lot of definitions. Okay, you're at, there you go. That's the historic. Let's stop there just for a minute. Come on, can you scroll back up to the top of those?
Mm-hmm.
All right, see, Board of Adjustment got moved to Chapter 12 along with Historic Preservation, Planning, and Zoning, so all those are strikeouts. This may not be the place where it shows up, but another approach I took with 160D was my attempt to make the code more user-friendly, both for staff as well as for the public, and I'll give you a prime example. In the current code, if you want to figure out what Board of Adjustment does, it may be in this section, it may be someplace else, but it simply says Board of Adjustment will have the duties and functions that are set forth in 168-388. That's it. That's all that it says. In actuality, Board of Adjustment currently, before 160D, hears appeals of zoning-related matters and variances. It follows quasi-judicial procedures. For variances, you have to prove certain elements. You need a 4/5 supermajority vote. And for appeals, there's all kinds of processes and procedures, again, geared towards due process consideration. So instead of the general reference to a statute to find all that, you'll see when we get to 12 that we've laid all that out. If you can go, keep going, Mandy, until we get to special use permits, that would be the next 0808 will be the next bunch of red. I've changed some language there, stylistic.
You said 0808?
0808. Permit choice, invested rights, they've been moved over to Chapter 12. There we go, special use permits. Now, I took everything that was there and struck it out. So if you'll notice, special use permits, now Manny, if you go down to the non-strikeout language. Now we're calling it quasi-judicial decisions. I can't take credit for that, that's Chapter 12. And it lays out the quasi-judicial decisions that are zoning related, so it's appropriate to put it into 15. You'll see here appeals. And I'm going to come back to, this is one of the bottom lines that 160D changes. I'm not going to spend time on it right this minute, but simply to tell you that the Board of Adjustment shall hear and decide appeals of administrative decisions under the town's development regulations. Let me digress for a minute and tell you a couple of things. The terminology has changed. And I'm going to go through that when we look at the 160D definitions. But for example, there'll be no more notices of public hearings and quasi-judicial hearings. There'll be notices of legislative hearings and evidentiary hearings. And you may think the terminology is not important, but it is. You've got to learn to speak the same language that the courts will be speaking in order to gain that extra element of persuasion when you appear in front of a judge. 160D does three things. It substantially increases the potential workload of the Board of Adjustment. It unifies how to amend text amendments. And it increases, I believe, significantly the risk of the town getting caught, getting named as a defendant in land use related litigation, where there is a risk if the private litigant wins that he gets awarded attorney's fees, but there's no similar provision for the town in that instance. Those are the three main takeaways. We'll cover that in 160D. But getting back to 15, I've simply laid out in a little more detail the special use permits that you all decide, and you do that through a quasi-judicial procedure. And that's laid out here. Mandy, if you can go to the next italics, which is probably, yes, certificates of appropriateness. Because I covered it as a quasi-judicial zoning decision, that's one of the changes I made later on in the historic district regulations. If I've covered it here, I took out some of it there. I didn't change anything substantively. So you've got BOA appeals, special use permits, certificates of appropriateness. That may be all. If you get to the end of the red ink, yeah, that is it. And those are the only changes to 15. With that in mind, unless there's any questions, I'm going to go back to... do I have to mirror my screen again?
No, I can follow you.
Well, I mean, I'll be glad...
Yes,
yes, sir.
Sorry. Yeah, this is Dave Engler again. So, I just noticed that we deleted all the vested rights stuff in 1508 and 75. So, is that driven by the state, or is that a recommendation from you?
They got moved to Chapter 12.
Okay, I didn't understand that. Sorry.
Yeah, we didn't lose them. As a matter of fact, we did those text amendments in fall. I don't know if you all know this, but the way that the State Bar Association got these rather huge rewrites of the land use planning and development regulation or statutory provisions was to give the other side, developers and real estate lobbyists, something that they were looking for. And that shows up in the permit choice rule that you were referring to, Councilman, also to the vested rights. It also shows up in the litigation risk that I mentioned, so we'll come back to that. But going back to Chapter 12, if you look at number 7, I mentioned that Chapter 12's table of contents illustrates the organizational approach taken by that chapter. So you've got your general provisions, you've got town boards and commissions. Again, this is dealing with land use planning and development, so that's why I brought PZC, HPC, and BOA covered in 1204. And that's why I moved some of it out of 2 and some of it out of 15 and brought it together with HPC in 12 section 04. You'll also see that where it currently you might have a cookbook recipe in the statute to regarding administration and enforcement, but in other cases you would have to look to case law or you'd have to jump to an entirely different part of 160A. One of the nice things that the statute has that the new chapter has done is it's unified those things that you see in 1206, administration, enforcement, and appeals. It's also unified how you adopt, amend, and repeal development regulations and judicial review. It clarifies that because all of that was case law. It's very easy to make a mistake. So now that's laid out, and again, because my approach was to be user-friendly, I have laid out some of that in detail. Before we get into Chapter 160D, substantively, I did want to point out under paragraph 8, A, B, follows on the next page, C, D, E, F. This is a wonderful summary of what constitutes conflicts of interest on all levels of the local government, from a quasi-judicial deciding board to staff, to the governing board. So this will be a very useful resource as these considerations tend to come up rather, they're not uncommon. They're not common, but they're not uncommon. So that'll be a very useful thing. 10, 12... Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt you. What other associational relationships does it define close familiar in F, but it doesn't define other associational relationships? So what does that mean?
Well, I'm not quite sure. We'll have to see how the... Where are you picking up that language?
The one that Manny's got on the screen right now says the third sentence at the very top. Close familial, business, or other associational relationship. I guess it's in B. I'm looking at what she's sharing.
It's insane.
And then down below in F, it defines familial relationship.
Yeah, I see.
I understand business or... Association with.
I'm still trying to find your language. He's looking at C.
In C.
Which, how many lines down?
I'm looking at
Mandy's pointing me to the
line. 1, 2, 3. The fourth, the fifth line. It says,
if it's down.
As a close familial, comma, business, comma, or other associational relationship.
I don't have a precise definition of that at the present time, and the statute doesn't have that definition. I'd go to the dictionary.
Sorry. Yeah. You were talking to define it, and I was like, I found everything else, but that was, just wondering if I missed it.
No, you didn't miss it, and you'd have to, the first place I would go is the dictionary to get a context. And of course, the main context is the conflict of interest context that we're dealing in.
Yes.
I mean, you might not.
Yes, sir.
You might be living with a significant other who's not a business relationship or a family relationship, but that's associational, and the conflicts of interest could arise in that context.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Definitions are where we really begin to understand how 160D works. So, and I've highlighted. You'll see some highlights from me. As we walk through chapter 12, sometimes they're GS-160D, sometimes they're KBC-XXX. Those are placeholders for me. The highlights that I want you all to look at, I'll point out. Administrative decisions. Decisions made in the implementation, administration, or enforcement of development regulations. You're going to see in a minute how expansive the definition of development regulations is. But I'll give you a range of what administrative decisions consist of. When John makes a decision on a building permit, that's an administrative decision. All the way on the other end of the extreme, when council makes a decision on subdivision plats, that's also an administrative decision. And everything in between. It's every decision made by any board or commission that has to do with land use development regulation and planning, that's not quasi-judicial. It's everything else. So what does that mean? It's every land use planning and development decision except special use permits, BOA appeals, variances, and certificates of appropriateness. Every other decision that has to do with land use planning and development is an administrative decision. And here's the first takeaway. I told you that 160D expands the workload of BOA. Currently, BOA hears appeals of matters related to zoning, interpretation, or decision. Under 160D, BOA hears appeals of all administrative decisions except subdivisions, minimum housing, and what other one that slips me at the moment. But everything else gets appealed to BOA. And that's a huge difference from what BOA's current scope of jurisdiction. All they hear right now are appeals of zoning matters. What they'll hear appeals of now are everything from building permits to stop work orders, things that aren't even related to zoning that are related to development regulations. As an aside, because I mentioned subdivision decisions are administrative, that's an exception by statute. Those decisions are appealed to Superior Court. development approval, you can read that for yourself, but I wanted to go on the next page to development regulation. This is another key example of how 160D has expanded and reorganized everything. What is a development regulation? A UDO, which is not relevant. Zoning regulation, subdivision regulation, erosion and sedimentation regulation, floodplain or flood damage prevention, stormwater control, wireless communication, historic district, housing code, building code enforcement, or any other regulation regulating land use planning or development. So you can see that administrative decisions dealing with that laundry list of what constitutes a development regulation, they all go to BOA. So that's an example of how BOA's jurisdiction has increased. But it's also, here's another example. In 160A, you can find a recipe for providing notice for amending a zoning regulation or a zoning map. Well, now 160D gives you that cookbook recipe for amending any development regulation. So it's where 160A was kind of focused narrowly on zoning, now 160D tells you everything you need to know about adopting or amending or appealing a development regulation, which could be stormwater, not just zoning. So that's an example. Yes, sir.
So, yeah, sorry to interrupt you. I think you said stormwater. So I know you're starting to look at giving the town the authority to enforce stormwater permits driven by the state changes. So how does that play out? If you give authority to the stormwater administrator, which is the public works director, and then they don't like these findings, that gets appealed to the Board of Adjustment?
I believe so, yes sir. But let's walk through 12 and see if you don't agree with that. Kind of keep that in mind. I did want to mention to you, Councilman, that you'll recall, and this is an aside for something that David and I have been talking about. You'll recall the audit where we need to come up with some ordinances that authorizes the town to grant permits not only for local but federal stormwater projects. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure, federal and state. Yes, that's what the state director has to do, which I'm not sure how we do that. But yes.
Well, I just wanted to mention to you, and because the audit gave us additional time beyond this 160D July 1st deadline, I didn't worry about it this program, but I found the statute in 160D that sets the stage for all that. So we'll be good to go on that once the 160D does settle.
Good. Yeah, so we have to be done by July 2022, so we have time.
Right.
That's why we have to push it, because we're busy on this. But I'm just interested, though, basically, if someone, as I understand what you just said, if someone disagrees with the town on a stormwater issue, including the Unified Development Ordinance or Stormwater Ordinance, they appeal that to the Board of Adjustment?
That's correct. You'll see when
I assume it comes to town council, and no. Town council can call or...
No, it goes to court after that. But why don't you keep those considerations in mind, because we will address that specifically in just a few minutes, and you can see if you agree with my reading or disagree with my reading.
Yes, sir, I will be quiet. Yes, sir.
Now, I don't want you to be quiet. I'm just trying to tell you where I'm going. Evidentiary hearing. Evidentiary hearing is a quasi-judicial hearing, legislative decision or text amendments, for example, that you might make. Legislative hearing is what we now call a public hearing. If you'll notice at the near the bottom of this section, subdivision regulation and zoning regulations are still carved out. Listen, this is one of the things I find kind of interesting about 160D. 160D tremendously expands the scope of development regulations and included in development regulations or zoning regulations and subdivision regulations. Not only does it expand the scope of what constitutes a development regulation, but it lays forth cookbook recipes for how you adopt that development regulation, how you repeal it, how you amend it, how you administer it, how you enforce it, and how you appeal that enforcement. So it provides a complete unified structure from top to bottom of how you deal with development regulations, which includes zoning regulations. What was interesting to me, you can take it or leave it, but I just make the point. Currently under 168, planning and zoning looks at a proposed text amendment to Chapter 15 zoning. You all act on that. Both of these bodies have to produce a consistency statement. You would think that with the approach taken by 160D, they would require that consistency statement, consistency of a comprehensive plan, for any development regulations, since that's what their focus is all about. But no, they still carve out consistency statement just for zoning. I don't get it, but anyway, that's where it is. So at the bottom of page 5, you'll see how we've moved and centralized the commissions and the Board of Adjustment into their proper place in the chapter that delegates authority to the town for land use planning and development regulations. Now, here's where we get into administration, enforcement, and appeals. And Councilman Hagler, I'll end this with, you'll see a lot of references to BOA along the lines that we just talked about. First of all, and of course, all this language, I didn't make any of this up. It all comes from Chapter 160D. I mean, maybe I rewrote it, but these are not my creations. These are the General Assembly's enactments. So look at the first one. The provisions of this article, and this is Article 6 under Chapter 12, and part of that article deals with appeals. So look at the application. The provisions of this article shall apply to all development regulations, including, Councilman Hagler, for example, stormwater regulations, because we know by the definition of development regulation that stormwater regulations are a development regulation. So this article applies to all development regulations. 1206.020 just kind of lays out the steps that you have to take for development approvals and providing notice to the applicant and the duration. I'm looking at C at the bottom of 6. Going over to the next page, it also tells you how to deal with changes that might be proposed to a development approval. Ed talks about revocations. You'll notice the last highlighted line of Ed, the revocation of a development approval may be appealed pursuant to BOA. It goes to BOA. Certificates of occupancy. One thing I want to point out in back up at D, the Chapter 160D, all of us can recall from time to time somebody getting a development approval, could be a special use permit, could be a subdivision plat. They come back into John and say, a year later, and say, look, I need to make this change or that change. And they might take the position that it's a minor change, but we may not have process and procedure in our code for dealing with a minor change. We do in two instances. Minor changes to subdivision plats are actually go through PCC. That was one of the interesting things that I relearned when I was reading that. They approve changes, minor changes to subdivision plats. We also have a provision in the historic district where John can approve or decline applications for minor work that results in minor changes. But I would ask council, and particularly John, to consider where else the town may benefit from defining minor work that may be administratively, i.e. staff, approved. for PZC, that's actually an administrative decision. For example, when they decide on a minor change to a subdivision plat. And there may be, I just defer to John and council, but there may be sections of development regulation approvals that John may feel would be beneficial for him to decide rather than bring it to another body. But if you want to do that, we have to text amend the code to define what that line of work is and to lay out the process for that administrative approval. So that's just something for you all and for John's department to think of. We're still in administration and enforcement of development regulations. 1206.030, again, provides your cookbook recipe for notices of violation. Again, the last line, a notice of violation for all development regulations, all administrative decisions concerning all development regulations. Where does it go? If you appeal that notice of violation, BOA. So there could be a notice of violation under a stormwater regulation. That appeal of that notice of violation goes to BOA, straight out of the statute. Stop work orders, again, they're appealed to BOA. It lays out remedies, which is essentially set forth in 168-175. That's anything from civil penalties to going to court for an order of abatement. And Councilman Hagler, this is the section that you and I were discussing a minute ago. 1206.040, appeals of administrative decisions. My note is, recall the definition of an administrative decision, and I quote it, decisions made in the implementation, administration, or enforcement of development regulations. That's pretty broad. If you keep the broad definition in mind, let's look at what Article 6-040 provides, appeals. Except as provided in KPC 1110.030E, that's appeals of the building inspector's orders concerning condemned buildings and structures. Except as provided in 1508.120G4, which is appeals of administrative decisions for minor work in the downtown overlay district. And except for KBC 1406.040, which is appeals on subdivision plats which go to court, appeals of administrative decisions and determinations made by staff under development regulations shall be made to the Board of Adjustment. I think that's pretty clear. You got three carve-outs that don't go to BOA, everything else does, and that's a substantial increase compared to what BOA does at the present time. Does so, that answer your question, or a little bit, Councilman Hagler?
It does, but I guess the question is, did the legislature intend that? Because the Board of Adjustments in small towns are not trained for stormwater, for multiple other issues that this just did. Did they really intend that, or is the plan that you're going to, because prior to this, multiple things would have ended up in council before court. This has changed that pretty drastically, in my opinion.
Well, that was the point that I made when I started, that 160D does substantially change, in particular, the workload of 160D. Look, I'm going to read you to my answer to your question as to whether the General Assembly intended that would be as follows. Yes, because in black letter law, that is exactly what they say. I will quote you from 160D 405 appeals. Except as provided in subsection C, and those were the exceptions that I spelled out that are applicable to this town. Appeals of decisions made by the staff under this chapter, and this chapter is the administration and enforcement and appeals and development regulations, shall be made to the Board of Adjustment unless a different board is provided or authorized, otherwise by statute or an ordinance. So, yes, it's black letter law. And as a matter of fact, when...
So if we wrote an ordinance that said all stormwater issues come to council instead of Board of Adjustment, does that mean that or not?
Speaking very generally, that, that you could... I think so, but I'm not going to answer that question authoritatively on the spot. The language of the statute... The language of the statute seems to suggest that you can come up with another body that would hear an appeal of an administrative decision. So my general response to your question is yes. But I also want to look at...
I just think for Curie Beach, and I'm speaking for every other town, all the other towns have the same issue, we either have to change the training for our Board of Adjustment pretty dramatically to include a bunch of other issues like stormwater, or we have to write ordinances that don't allow Jimmy telling a new permittee because the state just expanded his authorities and responsibilities. We write an ordinance that it doesn't go to Board of Adjustments, it goes somewhere else. And I'm okay with either one of those, we just got to understand which one we do.
A couple of things, points that I want to make. And to reinforce my... It was interesting writing 160D because the impacts of the legislative changes, they're not spelled out. Somebody didn't sit down and write or say, look, here's what 160D does, boom, 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 boom. So in writing 160D, these were realizations that came to me as understandings of how the changes impact operations. And the first realization I had was, whoa, this really increases BOA's workload. So I went back to one of my resources to kind of test that, and I found this language. Appeals of administrative decisions. The language is broadened, the language regarding appeals of administrative decisions is broadened to clarify that these provisions apply for appeals of administrative decisions under any development regulation unless an alternative appeal is provided by statute or ordinance. Goes to BOA in with quasi-judicial procedures. That's the first point I would make. Second point is, I've been BOA's attorney since 2014. We conduct annual training. I've been involved in quasi-judicial training and hearings for several towns since 2000. And I've also handled them individually for private litigants all the way through judicial review. So I understand very well how all that works. And I'm not sure that, it's up to council, but I don't think it's absolutely necessary to carve out an administrative decision under one development regulation as opposed to another and assign that to a different decision-making body. It may be. Council may determine that that is an efficient policy, but I guarantee you I'll have to come back and provide quasi-judicial training to that body for that purpose. But my third point is this. We are in the process of preparing training, 160D-related training, to the Board of Adjustment once the 160D dust settles. And I have to confirm which of these is the case. It may be that BOA, there's two standards of review that BOA does two things. It can conduct an evidentiary hearing to make a decision as it would for variances and appeals, variances and one certain type of appeals. But it also can conduct, and I have to double check this, it's called in the nature of certiorari, where BOA sits almost like an appellate court and reviews the record of what happened below to determine if what happened below was done correctly or otherwise. But for now, the focus is to conform the code to what 160D provides, and by the deadline. And the what we've done is to provide for appeals of administrative decisions made by staff shall be made to the Board of Adjustment unless a different board is provided as set forth above, those were the exceptions, or as otherwise authorized by ordinance. So the focus until the end of June is to adopt these text amendments, and built into these text amendments is the provision that allows you or council, in furtherance of Councilman Hagler's concerns, to set up different processes and procedures for appealing decisions, administrative decisions under other type of regulation, development regulations like stormwater regulations. So what you, if that's the way council wants to go, the tools are already in here. And since the tools are already in here, then I would suggest we turn our focus back to the text amendment in general, which provides the tool that you need if you want to carve out one appeal from another and to what board that appeal goes to. Agreed?
Yes, I'm good, sir. Yes, sir. I'm good.
So, looking further at appeals of administrative decisions, I'm not going to get into them, but everything that staff and the applicant and the town needs to know is set forth in this article. Standing, time to appeal, record of decision, stays. And then because such appeals are quasi-judicial in nature, you go to 12.6050, and everything staff needs to know for a quasi-judicial proceeding is, and whatever board, and I'm using the terminology here, whatever decision-making board is going to decide an evidentiary hearing, i.e. quasi-judicial, everything staff and that board needs to know is in this section. What process, notice of hearing, what materials. Materials, for example, can be distributed in a quasi-judicial evidentiary hearing. You can provide material because of the constitutional right to an impartial decision maker. You normally don't provide, as you would for an agenda like tonight, the materials for that agenda to the decision-making board ahead of time, because that may bias that board under a variety of circumstances from being the impartial decision maker. 160D allows you to provide those materials in advance of the meeting, provided you also provide those same materials at the same time to the applicant or the appellate. Just an interesting thing for staff to know. D at the bottom of 10 talks about presentation of evidence. E advises you that new issues can come up in the appeal. If it's a huge surprise, the decision-making board can continue the hearing. Oaths and subpoenas. I've been representing towns since 2000. I've never seen a decision-making board issue a subpoena, but there's always been occasions where I kind of thought I wish they would. Appeals in the nature of certiorari. Voting, this lays out 4/5 for variances. Everything else is majority. J tells you what you need for decisions, and K kicks you over to judicial review. My paragraph 12, Article 8 of Chapter 12, lays out the procedure for adopting, amending, and repealing development regulations, and I re-quote the very broad definition of development regulation, and you'll see, I didn't go into it, but 1208, if you just look at the table of contents, you'll see that this article provides, again, cookbook recipes for everything you need to know to adopt, amend, or repeal a development regulation. That brings me to my paragraph 13, which is judicial review. If you look at the table of contents of 1210, you'll see how they're carved out, declaratory judgments, appeals in the nature of certiorari, appeals of subdivision plats. I've highlighted 040 civil actions, 1250, again, is user-friendly. It provides the statutes of limitations for seeking judicial review. But let's look at 1210.040 for a minute. 1210.040 allows someone with standing, could be the appellant, it could be anybody affected by the administrative decision, to file a standalone prior thereto lawsuit. In other words, if I'm an applicant under a development regulation seeking development approval, and I get a decision that I think is wrong in a certain way, I can bypass, in most instances, going to BOA, and I can go right to the courthouse and sue Kerry Beach. All I've got to be able to do that, and just think how broad this is and how easy it is for, I don't mean making it up easy, I mean a good attorney, I think, could find somewhere in the mix a claim based on 1, 2, or 3, which allows you to go to court. That the ordinance is unconstitutional. That the ordinance that's being challenged is ultra vires. In other words, you did more than the authority that the ordinance gave you. Or that the ordinance constitutes a taking of property. I don't think it's very difficult to make those claims if you have the material to work with. I don't think it takes a super sophisticated attorney or a big law firm to come up with those claims. If you can come up with those claims, you can go to court. In most cases, you can bypass BOA and go directly to court. And that makes me want to refer you to the top of page 13, 621.7, attorney's fees. There are three, this paragraph packs a punch, and it offers nothing but risk to the town. There's two shalls and one may. In any action, which I think expands beyond development regulations, in any action in which a city is a party, upon a finding by the court that the city violated a statute or case law setting forth unambiguous limits on its authority, and administrative decisions are very limited, if you go beyond, if you're looking at a subdivision plat, if it meets the checklist, you green light it. If you try to slap a condition on that, that's quasi-judicial. This town's not set up to do that. So if I bring you a subdivision plat and you approve it with certain conditions, I'm going to go to court. I don't even have to tell you. But I'm going to go to court because that's beyond your authority. You made a quasi-judicial decision exercising discretion under a development regulation that was only to be decided administratively. So you acted ultra vires. I'm going to go to court. I'm going to claim you acted ultra vires. And when I win, I shall be awarded by the court attorney's fees. The last two lawsuits that I've been in, which were not, one was quite convoluted, but one was simply against an HOA and a town dealing with a declaratory judgment action, how to define a certain provision that consisted of three lines in Declaration of Covenants. Both parties spent six figures on that lawsuit. And this tells you that if that private litigant wins, he gets those attorney's fees. In any action in which a city is a party, upon a finding by the court that the city took action inconsistent with or in violation of vested rights provisions, that's what those statutes are, the court shall award attorney's fees to the party who successfully challenged the action. In all other matters, the court may award attorney's fees to the prevailing private litigant. But you all don't ever get to ask for attorney's fees. So, we have a legislative enactment that reorganizes land use development planning regulations, unifies how they're administered, enforced, and administratively appealed, how they are adopted, repealed, and amended, and that all the appeals except for three or four instances go to BOA, and that we're using new terminology. In the give and take between the developers and the practitioners to rewrite 160D, certain concessions were made to the development body. These two, just standalone judicial action and these attorney's fees, is very much part and parcel of that. So, to quote the, I can't remember who the character was, but during the police briefings on, what was that cop show? One Tree Hill or something like that. I might be mixing it up. But let's be careful out there, because the risk, BOA's workload has increased. I'm not too concerned, Councilman Engler, although it's a policy decision, but I think BOA can be trained to handle this increased scope of responsibility. But there is a risk of litigation out there and a risk of attorney's fees, so it behooves us, as we always do, to continue to be careful and wise as the town moves forward. This town does its work very well. But I did want to point out the fact that responsibilities have expanded and the risk is different. So we just need to be as vigilant as we've always been. Any questions? Sir?
Maybe, go ahead, John.
One question. The comment is, the show was Hill Street Blues.
That's it.
The question is, did any of this have impact either giving an HOA more authority or giving the members of that HOA?
No, no impact on HOA. And again, the general rule is if you've got a zoning regulation and a covenant, the more specific one controls.
Okay.
So no other impact of it. The general rule remains the same.
Thank you.
Just to say that this is troubling is probably a little bit of an understatement. I mean, we support the state constitution and the laws enacted by the legislature, but I'm a little confused by a process where we go through the process of enacting an ordinance, public hearings with the local individuals, setting up rules for plats and development activities. However, if they don't like that, they have the ability to circumvent every other administrative capability that we have, go to court and force us to pay for a very high cost, potentially high cost legal organization.
I would respond as follows, but before I respond, let me say one other thing that I forgot to mention. Currently, the only time you have a public hearing for a text amendment is if you text amend the zoning map, if you amend the zoning map, or you text amend Chapter 15. Under the new procedure for 160D, all text amendments to any development regulation will require, and I say I use the old language, will require notice of a legislative hearing. So last month, or the month before that, when we lickety-split changed the civil penalty for trash carts, that was no longer going to be possible after July 1. What would have happened in that instance with 160D is we would come in and fix a date for the public hearing, have the public hearing, and then the next month take up the text amendment for consideration. In that particular instance, I think John and I spoke on a Thursday, and you all had it on a Monday. That's not going to be possible anymore, because any text amendment to any development regulation, again, which is very broadly defined, requires a legislative hearing. But let me answer your question. There's always a risk of litigation, because anybody can go to court and file a lawsuit. The only thing that you can do is to do it right. And that's why you're blessed with good staff, and I don't mean to blow my own horn, a good attorney. We help you to do it right. And you all know me by now that I pretty much insist on that, even if it slows the wheels down a little bit, and even if I'm perceived as being overly comprehensive. But doing it right is the best risk management strategy there is. So I don't think it's a question of having done something other than the unpredictability and the variability and the and it being equally true that bad things happen to good people, particularly in court. I can't rule out a lawsuit that results in an adverse ruling to the town. But generally speaking, if you do it right, and you can prove that you do it right, even though there's a risk of litigation and a risk of attorney's fees, it doesn't mean it's going to happen. Your best risk management strategy, your best practices strategy is just to do it right. And that's what this town does. I'm just pointing out the fact that it wouldn't surprise me if we end up in litigation sometime in the next few years, just because that ability is there. Am I concerned about losing and having the town taxed with attorney's fees? No, because I take the assumption that we'll always do it right. Can I guarantee that a judge won't get it wrong? No, I can't. But what more can we do other than to do it right and work the system as the system allows us to do?
Thank you for that answer, Counselor. I seem to remember a counselor, famous gentleman, who told me that don't get into a discussion of right because that's what courts are for. Okay. All right. Well, Jim, that was very comprehensive. You covered a ton with a very basic message that is understandable and requires some thought.
Thank you. Three more quick points. We need to fix a date for the public hearing. We need to also perhaps consider a date for a special meeting, because if you do the public hearing for your next June meeting on June 21, we've got till July 1 to adopt the amendments. And my final point is there isn't any wiggle room that I can see regarding these. I mean, it's straight out of the statute. So if you want to fix the date and see who's available during the last week of June for a special meeting, we can take it from there.
We could do the special meeting or the public hearing at 5 p.m. on the 21st, 30 minutes before our emergency meeting. And then we'd have to come back 24 hours later, at a minimum, right?
Well, 48 hours.
48 hours, so that would be Monday. You'd have to come back Wednesday afternoon at 5 p.m. on June the 23rd. David, what's your schedule like? Do you know that far out in advance?
Not right now.
Okay.
Well, we could take a poll.
I mean, set it is, and I'll call in, or I'll try to. If you make it Monday or Friday, I'll be everything again to be there.
Well, we could do it Monday. We could do it Monday the 28th, then a week later.
Yes, yeah, minimum of 48.
But we shouldn't be surprised by this 160D stuff. This is just a continued aggressive erosion of local municipalities' power to govern themselves. And we've all seen it coming for the past few years.
Okay.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I'll say if we did not do it by phone, if we did not have a team meeting.
So, gentlemen, let's set the date.
We
were recommending, Joseph.
Mayor, can you give me just a second, please? You would get rid of the remote participation. Yeah, I think you could do that.
So if they have a public hearing, couldn't they make the decision that council meeting?
I don't really have a problem with that. I
didn't
go back
into a problem with that.
We're not going to
get out of here for that. And we're not going to have a public hearing that way.
That's
okay. We'll roll with it. Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
Sorry, I was trying to say a special meeting.
But we couldn't do it.
Okay.
Well, we agreed that the next emergency meeting is going to be at 5:30 on the 21st.
Public hearing at 5 on the 21st.
Emergency meeting at 5:30.
And then we'll do the follow-up.
I can do that.
Follow-up special meeting on the 28th at 5:30.
Why do we need to? I don't understand the reason for that.
Because we have to wait. If we have the public hearing, we still have to wait 48 hours before we can vote on it.
Okay, I understand now.
Well,
okay.
So I'm trying to give you plenty of time with your unknown schedule at this point.
That's fine.
Okay.
Or you can make it Friday if you want, whichever one.
Oh, Friday?
Whichever one you have, I'll file in one.
I'm really
mad at you. You can make it Wednesday. He can call in, right?
Sure. I mean, David can call in if it works.
Yeah, I can call in if you want to do it on Wednesday, too, the 23rd.
Okay.
No, the public hearing is going to be the 25th, so we're talking.
The 21st at 5 p.m.
I'm sorry.
Whatever the rest of the council can do, I will make sure I'm at least in attendance personally, and I'll try to be there in person. So you guys make whatever works for the rest of you.
We do have a stormwater committee meeting on the 28th at 5:30, and Heckler runs that meeting.
But sometimes he doesn't work.
That's following Monday. Okay, so we have the meeting for the 21st. That's a public hearing. And then we will get back together. What was the recommendation? Wednesday at 5:30, which is the 23rd.
Yeah.
Can we not do the budget public hearing and this public hearing on 160D at the same time, same day?
That's kind of up to staff
and
you got
any
time to...
I'd asked about that, but I was told no.
Does that give us all the time requirements?
That's what I'm checking.
When's that public hearing?
The
8th. The
7th. It's actually proposed for the 7th, but you have to set that.
Yeah, we've got it.
We have
10:25.
I don't have enough time. You don't have enough time?
Just a question.
Okay.
What's another meeting for?
Okay. Glad we get paid so well.
You know, our decisiveness is a little struggling today.
So is there a consensus on Wednesday the 23rd at 5:30?
That's fine. That is the suggestion at this point, if everybody can make it.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, I'll make sure.
So, should we have a motion?
I make a motion. We have the special meeting on Wednesday, June 23rd at 5:30 to approve 160D.
Did you do a motion for the...
I'll second.
We've got to get a motion for the public hearing first.
We haven't set the public hearing yet.
All right. I make a motion we do the public hearing at 5 p.m. on the 21st.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, move on, Joe.
I make a motion we do the special meeting on June the 23rd at 5:30 p.m. for the approval of 160D.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Good job, Jim. I know it's been busy for you.
A lot of complexity in here, but I think you explained it very well, Counselor. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Mayor.
Beth, can we get Apple invites for all these meetings so I can have it in my calendar because this is getting a little much.
I'll send
out an email. Did you have a question, John?
I have it. Tommy,
just for these.
Mr. Harrington is now in the audience. Can we allow him to do his presentation after the next two committees?
I believe we can, but I would tell you that we probably got about 20 minutes for you.
Charles, you want to go ahead and do
that? He can do that.
Mm-hmm. Sure, thank you.
Sorry?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Actually, We can let you come up now. There's no reason for you to sit through our budget.
Thank you. Actually, let me introduce Dr. Charles Benedict, who will do the presentation. Dr. Benedict is the...
Hey, President, quick demand. Is Layden Lester still on? He was on earlier.
No, he's not.
No,
he's not.
Did you want to get the other two...
Come together.
I'm sorry?
You want to get the other two committees out of the way quickly before...
The other two committees, I believe. Let me see.
It's SLAP.
And Stormwater.
Well, Stormwater, do you have anything to...
Yes, sir.
Shoreline Access?
Yeah.
Dennis, you have anything?
Yeah, just a brief update on the sign situation for the access points.
Yes.
So, signs have been ordered. We had quite a few signs to get ordered, so we've had almost 100 signs that are currently being printed now, and that includes stay off the dunes, address signs, no doves on the beach signs, and we're also getting some new rip current signs. So whenever they get in, we'll work with Public Works to have these things put in. The other signs that we're putting in are the marker signs. I think I sent out an email to everybody that we're going to have mile markers along the beach. So we've got roughly 3 miles of beach shown here. So every tenth of a mile, we're going to have a mile marker. It's going to be bright red and white signs. So hopefully people can see both during the day and at night. If there's any emergencies, they need to report their location.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis.
Any questions?
Thank you and the group for
Dennis,
what you
the committee have done a great job on this.
Yep, nice job.
And police chief and fire chief with their input on everything.
Stormwater. David?
Nothing to report.
Okay, all right, it finishes the committee business and we can move on to your presentation.
Commissioner Whitley and Commissioner Oliver and myself heard this briefing at the Byways about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, and were interested enough of this innovative approach to renourishment of sand on the beaches that we invited Stephen Harrington and his colleague to make this presentation to us.
Okay.
Good evening and thank you. Are you able to pull up?
I am.
Thank you.
One quick second.
So I'll explain a little bit about this, which you'll see soon shortly. New Shore mitigation system was invented by Dr. Benedict several years ago, originally because he had come into a personal issue on a home in the panhandle of Florida where he had severe beach erosion. And as a result, he has developed this and has put it in several locations in Panhandle of Florida and in Puerto Rico, and is now in the process of putting it again in the Destin Beach area. And it's very unique in its ability to capture sand already in the waves and re-nourish the beaches. It doesn't pull sand from other locations. It uses the natural sand that's in the ocean to build out the beaches. If you could go to the next, thank you. I don't want to. Then the concept is these temporary groins are put out with a meshing in between, and as the waves come in between the meshing, it calms the waves down, thereby building the beach back up naturally. You can go to the next. And unlike a traditional groin, where usually one side you find erosion and the other side you find growth in the beach, this doesn't do that. You go to the next slide. Yeah, there again. This sort of explains how it works, how the wave action captures the sand. And like you said, there is no downdrift erosion with this system. So if you were to put it in a certain location, which is one reason why we were late, is we took the opportunity to drive down to the end right by Fort Fisher
sure.
to see those houses, and we saw all the
yeah.
the panels there. So you go to the next, So I want to show you so we don't take up too much of time. Here you see a picture of when it was first put in, and I want to say, correct me, Charles, but I think this is something like 6 months later. Like, yes, same system in place for 6 months, and you see how it just builds up the beach naturally. So typically, like in Florida, which I'm sure it's sensitive to hear, is Florida always looks at doing this sort of in the winter months, non-turtle season, you know, slower season. So something like this for up here would be perfect, so where you could put it in, like in October, November, take it out in March, April, right before tourists come, and you would have replenished the beach in a more natural way. You can go to, so they're just going to show you some more pictures. There again, you see where it's started.
Quick question, is that vertical or horizontal?
It's perpendicular to the it's perpendicular out to the water.
Okay.
So I think if you go down to this that next one, you can just kind of scroll through.
Oh, there, okay.
So this meshing is what in between, you see where the water is here and how it has built out in between.
It moves it out, it moves the mean high water line out like 70 feet. And it put in 6 feet of sand up against that building. It was 3 feet underneath the building, below the last step on the stairs, and it was almost 2 feet, and I guess about 2 feet up on the steps.
So you can go to the next photos.
Now, how do you anchor the posts to hold the wave action?
They are jetted down like pilings,
Okay.
And they're down 12 feet. So they're anchored very tight.
Okay.
And they're up like 15 feet, something like that. They're 21 feet long, so 12 feet would be 9 feet. So they're up 9 feet. Those panels, you'll see the panels. This was our initial experimental work that we did. What we found out was we had to have something that would survive and not be difficult to pull up. So we redesigned it so that every 10 feet, there's a panel. And then there's another panel, and there's another panel. So when the panels, when the sand builds up on the lower part of the panel where you see the smaller pores, then what we do is we lift those up. And we can lift those up out of the sand. You can't do it when they're one long string.
That's kind of clever. So the top lets the water through a lot easier.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it works extremely well. You have to have sand movement, of course. And what he was saying, Stephen was saying a minute ago, is you're bringing the sand in. The sand comes in off of the sandbar. And then it's cross shore. And then it goes long shore or littoral in the direction of flow. And it goes back out again to the sandbar. It's a big circular motion as it goes. So what we've been doing is taking about 10% of the sand coming in from the sandbar and keeping it there and growing it 10%.
Mm-hmm.
It does not affect the updrift or the downdrift. It stays the same. We proved that by having, areas where we actually monitored updrift and downdrift to make sure it wasn't robbing sand from downdrift. And people are really concerned about that. So the whole thing is based on streamlined flowing of the water. So that the sand is turbulent as it moves along. The water is streamlined so it can fall out.
Mm-hmm.
And I use this as an example because I've designed sewage treatment plants. It's like the polishing pond in a sewage treatment plant. It slows the water down, takes the turbulence out, and allows it to fall out. In a polishing pond, you put the you put the effluent in on one end, it's great big, and it flows slow to the other end, giving the suspended solids time to fall down. So at the end, the effluent is cleaner. We're just applying the same technology, engineer from engineering point of view.
And because the sand has previously been on the beach, the compatibility of the sand is perfect, I guess.
It's exactly the same sand. We're bringing back the sand, some of the sand, that has been eroded and sent out. And later on, the sandbar replenishes itself from offshore sand.
These are Gulf Shore beaches?
Yes.
So have you had an implementation on the Atlantic coast?
No.
On the ocean beach?
No, so you don't have any data. You just have to do it a little differently. And it's going to require an experiment, which is fine. This is what this was. These two things were done on Eglin Air Force Base property on the beach. And this building was the original officers' club.
Come down a slide like 12, see above. You can, go back to 11. Well, you can see the water was all the way up to the wall here, and there it is after.
And that was like 3 weeks, three weeks after we put it in. It put in 9 feet of sand up against that seawall. The seawall was about to fall over because it had taken all the sand out from in front of it and was actually pulling the sand from behind the seawall. You can see that there. First upper left.
How far out in?
On the bottom line also.
How far out into the water do those fence structures go?
We take them out. In this case, we took them out 150 feet.
Beyond the shoreline?
From the mean high water line out.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because the larger pores in the upper part of it mitigate, or actually kind of take some of the energy out of the waves. So that when it does get to the beach, it's not as violent.
So have y'all had a conversation with Fish and Wildlife or Coastal Resource Commission or anybody like that?
To be honest with you, when I was at the conference a couple of weeks ago, what I was there to learn sort of the system. Who do I go to first? Who do I go to second? I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, all this would have to be permitted.
Yep.
And there's a lot of... I mean, they wouldn't even let us drive a trailer with water on the, in a barrel to water the sea of it the last time the government was into it.
Right. No, it's one of the things we're trying to learn is the process. You know, obviously we're trying to get to the point where, you know, they'll let us do an experiment someplace and put it in. You can go to the next slide. So it just shows the more of the system going. It's just more examples of how it, you can see over time how it worked.
See, that picture right there was a week after we put it in.
Yes.
As you said, those are spaced 10 feet apart, so that would be roughly about 20 feet growth in
right.
A week.
Well, actually, it grew all the way out because you can see that it's forming some right out there on the left edge. There's a little trough through there, if you will. That section was left in for 16 months during turtle season to show that it had no effect on turtles. We had to monitor, environmentally monitor these things 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 6 months at the first site and 16 months at this site. We have all the data, all the environmental data, all the engineering data.
Yeah, you can go ahead and show that. Yeah, there you see more.
That's what it looked like after 16 months. We put in, I think, 38,000 cubic yards and 1,500 feet.
And we're about to put an installation in Destin. Is it Destin, actually?
And one's in Destin and one's on Okaloosa Island near Fort Walton.
Roughly 6,500 feet, something like that.
And that first site that you saw was about half a mile west of that long jetty that's at Destin where they have East Pass. The jetty itself is like 1,400 feet long, I think.
So did Florida Fish and Wildlife have a permitted, was it permitted through something in Florida?
I mean, yes, because the law changed. Explain how the law changed.
It was approved by the DEP, Florida Department of Environmental Protection, by the FWC, Florida Wildlife Fish, by the Corps.
Engineers.
Army Corps of Engineers, and three other agencies. We submitted a joint application to the DEP, and they took care of everybody else, okay, bringing them together. And even with that, it took a long time.
You can go up and stand there, just look at that.
And that lower one just shows the site and shows the deposition. We had to do a survey every week, I think it was.
Go ahead. Some more examples of it. You have the presentation so you can see.
This was in Inlet Beach. It was right after a hurricane. I can't remember the name of it.
You can tell by the FEMA tarp.
Pardon?
You can tell by the FEMA tarp.
Yeah. They came on and they scraped all the sand they could up and put it up against the dune. So when we started it, it had been scraped. And when you look at the final photograph, you'll see the sand up on the beach beyond where we start the drawings. It was full of sand. See how they scraped it off? But when you finish up, all the sand that's on there to the right, where you saw it scraped off, that was sand that was deposited as a result of the sand that we brought in, the wind-blown sand. And that's not included in the survey that we did. And that's just showing the difference.
Yeah, that was another part of the order we go. But I think you get the concept. This was in Puerto Rico. So you see it there. You can see them perpendicular.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it gets installed.
This was a little over a mile long. And the people use it.
It's 25. See that?
They would put their blankets or their sheet there, their big towels out.
Some of them play volleyball.
They play volleyball across it. They do all kinds of things. So it didn't slow down the tourism activity.
So how much maintenance does it take over the course of the time?
It takes somebody monitoring it
daily.
Because you don't want, all of a sudden you can have a difference in the flow of the water due to a storm or do whatever. And so you don't want to bury it so much that it's difficult to pull up. So we monitor it every day.
26, 27, you'll see more here.
The only thing that happened environmentally was that a seagull floated in that had fishing twine wound up all around it. And that's the one from there.
Does the slope of the beach make a difference how quickly it drops off?
It does to a degree. Like here on the Atlantic, it's going to make a difference because it's pretty steep.
Yeah.
So it'll bring it in and carry that out and probably keep the same slope, maybe a little bit steeper places, maybe a little bit less, depending on how the waves bring the sand in. But over here it's a lot rougher too. See, we have a small tidal variation of about 2 feet.
We were wondering, what's the tide here? Because when we were down there now, how much is the tide?
5 foot tide.
5 foot?
5 feet, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, in those Florida beaches, who owns those beaches? Are those private, or are they state-owned, or county-owned, or how are they?
All of the above.
Sorry?
All of the above? Everyone has access.
The state of
I mean, because in the state of North Carolina, the beaches are state-owned.
Well, actually,
right?
The state owns all the beaches.
Yeah,
the
so...
There's a bunch of arguments going on here and there.
Any projects we do come through the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, as soon as the storm's over, like a hurricane, they'll come in and resurvey the mean high water line, and everything below the mean high water line is state-owned. Whatever that is.
I understood some of that was on
along Eglin Air Force.
Eglin Air Force, but it's still, the state still has control of it. Eglin was the sponsor for that program. And I got that basically because I've been doing work for the Air Force and Eglin.
So, hopefully we'll try to work the process here to get an installation somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, we're certainly familiar with the way it works. I'm not necessarily this, how the erosion and everything else works. I mean, we're...
Well, it works better when you saw the seawall.
Mm-hmm.
In 2 weeks, we had almost 9 feet of sand up against it. And the reason hard structures are bad is because you have reflection of waves when they hit the wall.
Right.
Down and around.
Mm-hmm.
They have all kinds of things to try to mitigate that by making the waves come up and go back this way as opposed to this way. In our case, the sand has a real high movement, and so we gather the sand very rapidly. I suspect from looking at what we saw this afternoon when we were there that the amount of erosion that's occurring is pretty rapid, apparently. And they've got those great big tubes, they're shorter than most of the tubes, full of sand stacked up. It's going to take the sand off of those. If you get sand deposited on top of them, if you don't do something else, the sand will come and go and it'll deteriorate those things after a while. That's what our experience in Florida has been. But you need something that will hold the sand there and not let it go away. So the sand, most likely than not, from an engineering point of view, is going to build up and go out. And this is not a do-all, end-all. You're going to get erosion. I don't care what you do. You're going to get erosion. It mitigates the erosion. It'll go away and you can bring most of it back. But it's going to erode. That's all there is to it. And the thing about it is, we're bringing back the very sand that was there to start with, not some foreign sand from dredging. Because it has a different grain size, it has a different composition. Like in Florida, that sand that you saw is snow white. It's the sand that was there. And all we're doing is bringing it back. And like I said, in that second area, when we built the sand up out there against the seawall, the sandbar depleted. You can see it over time going down. And the waves weren't breaking over the sandbar. 9-10 months after we took Goran out, the sandbar came back. So it was pulling sand from offshore onto the sandbar. Mm-hmm. So basically what that system does is it brings the sand back, or a percentage of it.
Mm-hmm. Alan, do you have any questions or any points?
No, I think there's still a lot of questions out. I think, you know.
Now's the time to ask?
Them getting permitting would answer a lot of it once they're permitted. I think there's a lot of discussion to have with the Army Corps of Engineers also to hear how it would affect our projects and what we're doing with the federally funded projects right now.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. I would say it looks incredibly interesting. If you don't need to bring dredges up, you don't need to lay pipe, you don't need to look for an area where sand is compatible and then pump it a couple miles. I mean, a lot of the things are compelling. I can see a lot of upside. I'm just not smart enough to see what any of the downsides are on this thing, right?
Another concern is how does this affect the normal migration of sand? Because we know, you know, that sand is going to migrate from north to south, you know, so yeah. Is it going to affect that too? That's another, you know, we don't know that yet.
You know, in our experience in Florida with the ones that we did, the one in Puerto Rico, it doesn't have any effect on downdrift as far as taking sand away from downdrift. because it's all coming off the sandbar.
Okay.
I mean, we have the data, and all of the data says that. So that was one of the reasons for doing the experimental program to start with, was to find out what it was, what it would be doing to the flow of sand. Because it's a river of sand.
Right.
But it's coming in. See, normally what it does is it comes in and doesn't really erode until you get more than Florida. It doesn't really start eroding until you get a storm or you get heavy water, which will take the sand out. As time goes on, a lot of that sand does come back on its own.
So, so the wind patterns, I mean, here, when we get a nor'easter, we get a pretty violent, that's when we see the most beach erosion.
Right, and you see what happens.
But then the next day, or a day or two later, it can be shifting and coming from the southeast.
Right, exactly.
So and does that affect the fencing or the growing that's in the water?
No, the only thing it can affect is the sturdiness of it. The way the growings are made now are in 10-foot panels. And are you familiar with the orange stuff that they put around construction sites? Mm-hmm. Well, we've got some called GeoGrid, and it's real, real heavy. It's black, so the ultraviolet doesn't get to it. And it's very sturdy. And since we're putting it in 10-foot sections, we're not getting the forces on the ends like you would if they were longer. So we experimentally worked until we got some that would withstand the system at Lynn Inlet Beach, that one that you see there on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
We had a hurricane come through while that one was in. And we didn't lose any panels. We had three of them damaged, but we didn't lose any. And the beauty of this whole thing is you can put it in, take it out, put it back in, or just take it and put it in another area. It's critically eroded, what we call in Florida, we call them hot spots.
So who installs them and who maintains them?
We do.
Your company does?
We do.
Maybe last question. I mean, it's intriguing. What's the biggest problem you face? I mean, we can see how good it is. I always ask this question. So what's the biggest problem you face when you do this?
After we get the permit?
Yes. After the permit. Yeah, after the permitting, absolutely.
The biggest problem it's a problem, the most work associated with it is, and like I was mentioning him there a little earlier, is you have to monitor it daily. And if they can get bowel fouling, like seaweed, you have to get it off there. And if you have crustaceans that get on it, you pull panels up and pressure wash them. And you have extra ones anyway, you put them in, pressure wash them, and they'll be ready to go back in. So bowel fouling, and seaweed are the two biggest problems.
Okay.
That puts an extra load on, as you can imagine.
Okay, yeah.
And so you have to keep the seaweed off.
Well, thanks for the honesty on that, then. Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
And thank you for getting to the crux of it pretty quickly.
You mentioned earlier that you had experience because of dredging in this. Perhaps if I could meet with one of you and sort of ask you what are your normal process steps, because maybe that's the exact steps we need to do. You know, do we go see Army Corps of Engineers first? Do we go see DEQ first?
Well, normally we go to the Army Corps first because they get the cash,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. So yeah. we normally have to have them in the process, but we have our own people in the county.
The department that handles the beaches and the projects.
Right.
Yeah, the equivalent of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection.
Yeah, here in the county we have a department that leaves me what the name of the department is, but they have a gentleman that handles it for the county, so I think that would be a good place to start.
Yeah, he can lead us to the other parts.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Benedict.
Before we hop into this, gentlemen, after 2.5 hours, 5-minute break.
Mandy's got to get it. She's giving us that.
We ordering pizza?
You're not having barbecue?
All set? Mandy, we all set? Okay, let's convene. Department head business, administration.
So we need to set a date for our department head evaluations.
June 21st, noon. June 21st at noon.
Okay, so we have that meeting on June 21st at noon. June 21st for the public hearing. We also have a special meeting on the 23rd, which is a Wednesday. So we can do a Monday or a Wednesday that week. But if we do it on Monday, Monday's going to be a long day for you guys. We got a council meeting that night, too.
I might not be able to be in town on Wednesday, so I would just do it on Monday.
Suspend the day together.
Spend the day together on Monday?
Yeah.
All right.
We have you guys to look to. You do it all the time.
I do think a motion.
We need a motion for that.
Okay.
I'll make a motion to move the department head evaluations on Monday, the 21st of June.
Starting at 12 o'clock.
Starting at 12 o'clock.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Favor.
Okay, we got it, Manny.
Thank you.
Thank you. Building Inspection Department. Is a pergola on the deck?
It is on the deck. It still would not be connected to the house, but it would be an additional structure. And you can see the site plan there. It should be in your material. But it would be the exact same dimensions as the deck, and based on the elevation provided, would be about 10 feet tall.
Are they required to provide an engineer? Something engineered to do the...
No, sir. Prescriptive building code is all that's needed. Although I haven't checked the drawing here, it looks like it is sufficient. Once again, this is in the easement area on Settlers Lane.
And what is the concrete pad?
Yeah, I was looking at that.
That's not as easily to remove as a piece of wood.
I don't see a concrete pad. I see the concrete footers that they've drawn for the posts.
Well, the words say four concrete pad.
Yeah, right there under the 2x2x2. Previous page.
Yes, on 2x2x2 four concrete pad with 5/8 rebar. I don't know why they put pad, but that should be a footer. Hence the dimensions of 2x2x2.
Okay.
That is 2x2 and then 2 feet deep.
Yes, sir. It's pretty substantial. Yes.
Can you still move it, Jimmy?
Absolutely.
It's attitude I like.
Is
that him?
Yeah, we didn't hear you, David.
I said, with no problem, I'll include it.
John, we never approved a pergola before.
How about where else?
For any of those easements along Steadworth there.
Yes, sir.
There's several through there, right?
I'm not aware of any.
I mean, there's several decks built.
There's decks, yes, sir. Yeah.
But no pergolas. That you know of.
That I know of, no, sir.
What are the downsides, John? Any?
You're probably going to get some more requests for approvals and pergolas. But as Jimmy said, it's not really going to prohibit him from doing what he needs to do in that easement. It can be easily removed.
It is our easement, but it is
their property, you know, so.
On the site plan and everything and on the plat map, the fourth main's not located on there anywhere. Yeah, how close is it, Jimmy? Is it in the center of that easement, or how does that fourth main run through the easement?
I mean, we actually went out there to their property and located it for them, and we stuck flags on the fences so the construction guys will know exactly where our fourth main is.
So from the edge of their deck to where the fourth main is, how much room do you have?
Sir, I'm really not sure. I'm almost probably safe. 8 feet, maybe.
And how deep is that fourth
main? The fourth main's around five and a half feet deep.
So it's not that deep?
No. I mean, it will make...
You see what I'm saying? I'm saying shoulder
and back. It will make a big hole if something was to happen, yes.
Yeah, I'm just thinking if you have to shoulder back from the... If you had to, and you have to come in and dig a hole... Ditch, you can't just dig it right over the pipe, so you got to feather it back and everything.
Exactly.
So that was my whole reason I was asking the question.
If we had to dig it up, we would much have to move farther than that. That is a fact.
Okay, now you did. And I'm fine with that. I just think that the property owners need to know that it could get complicated. When it happens, it's going to happen sometime.
Let's hope not.
I know.
I've been here 13 years, we've had two forced main to break, so, I mean, I don't know.
But there's
always that possibility. Yeah. Yes, sir.
If you don't mind, they submitted the same approval letter to you guys that was dated March 22nd. If you guys decide to approve this, I'd like to have it rewritten. That would address immediate removal.
Not 30 days.
Not 30 days.
I saw that 30 days.
And it also needs to address that you guys are allowing them to do a pergola. So.
Yeah, we can't wait.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it was a forced main break, we can't wait.
If you guys decide to approve that, I'd recommend that, and obviously have it notarized.
Okay. Any other thoughts, counsel? If we're in favor.
I'm okay with the change, not opposed.
Okay, then we would need a motion here.
I'll make a motion to direct the building inspector to press on there to be changed and we'll approve that as a business.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Aye. Anyone?
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you, John.
Thanks, sir.
Finance. Should we go through the others first, Arlen?
Yeah, that's
fine. We won't make them. Fire department. Anything?
Nothing, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. Police department?
Nothing, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. Public Works?
Nothing unless you guys have any questions from me.
None from me. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Jimmy. Recreation Department?
No updates this month.
Okay. Are we done filming?
Yes, with this project.
Okay. With that project. Okay. That project's done. Okay. Now, finance.
Thank you.
If there's no particular controversy on any of your department head items, feel free to go. It's been a long day for you. All right. No takers. Tough crowd.
Harlan's the only one
willing to go.
That's a great presentation.
And
so please present the fiscal year 22 Cary Beach budget. I just want to go over a couple basic things. Okay. So one is just some information about the budget preparation. So it is in conformance with the North Carolina General Statutes and also with the Local Government Budget and Fiscal Control Act. One thing that council will have to do is set a time for a public hearing after the budget's presented, you know, this evening. The public hearing will have to be scheduled for that. The proposed date for that is Monday, June 7th at 6 p.m. Once this proposal is accepted this evening, it will be made available on the town's website and then also on file with the town clerk if anyone would like to review the details. And then we do have to adopt the balanced budget or an interim budget by July 1st. So some other basic things. The actual proposal is made up of three parts: the budget message, which provides summarizes the budget, provides key differences from the current year; the draft budget ordinance, which shows the budgeted revenues and expenditures by fund and also other statutory requirements; and then the draft fee schedule, which is all the fees and other items the town charges for services. Also, if anybody would like, there's a detailed line item budget for all departments and all revenue items. And that what was put together here, the proposal, is based on everything that was discussed at the annual council retreat and the budget work session. So I'll start with the just a quick overview of the seven funds that make up Cary Beach. The general fund, the budget, the proposed budget, and I'm going to round things here, is $6.6 million. Water and sewer fund is $2.8 million. Stormwater fund is about $700,000. PAL bill fund is $318,650. Federal asset forfeiture fund, $25,000. Sewer expansion reserve fund, a little over $9,000. And the beach protection fund, about $400. So the grand total for all of Cary Beach funds is $10,466,000.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to figure out where that comes from.
That's David.
David can hear it. And I needed David. It's not David. Let me, 2 seconds. I'm just going to hit the power on the mic real quick and start.
Yeah, I'll mute it, Jeff.
That was me.
Oh. I can't get it to stop.
So what I'll do next is kind of briefly go through each fund and just kind of give the highlights for each one of the funds. So for the general fund, our largest fund, overall this fund is about 16% higher than the current year budget. The proposed tax rate is 26.58 cents, which is 1 cent over revenue neutral tax rate, which we'll talk about in just a minute. There are no general fund fee increases included. The budget includes the addition of two full-time employees in the fire department, also includes a 1.3% cost of living adjustment and 3% merit increase for full-time employees. This budget also includes capital expenditures of approximately $402,000, and the fund has debt service of just about $680,000. So what I thought I'd do next is just kind of quickly walk through the revaluation of property that was done by the county. So it's just some general information that a revaluation is required at least every 8 years. That's a North Carolina law. New Hanover County, with the last revaluation in 2017, moved to a four-year cycle. And really that the purpose of revaluation is really just to kind of bring properties to market value so that there's a more equitable distribution or allocation of property taxes. So next I just wanted to show the status of the revaluation, and what I did is I listed all the jurisdictions here within New Hanover County. As you can see, countywide values have increased about 12.2 billion, or about 40%. For Curie Beach, we've gone up about 323 million, or about 36%. And the column at the far right just shows the percentage for each jurisdiction of the total revalued property. So Curie Beach represents approximately 3% of the total value of property in New Hanover County. So next I just wanted to show the entire tax base for Curie Beach. So the top line is the real property that we just talked about that was subject to revaluation. The other components, smaller parts, personal property, business personal property, motor vehicles, state appraised property. They're all provided by the New Hanover County Tax Department, provides those estimates. So that the grand total tax base for Curie Beach is approximately $1.25 billion. And that's an increase of about 35% from last year. So I mentioned before about revenue neutral, and that's something that's done anytime there's a revaluation. And the revenue neutral tax rate is really the tax rate that's estimated, it's kind of a long definition, but estimated to produce revenue for the next fiscal year equal to the revenue that would have been produced for the next fiscal year by the current rate if no reappraisal had occurred. But it goes beyond that because you also then do an adjustment for what is the average annual growth in the tax base. You kind of adjust it that way so that you can then project what the tax rate would be if there would not have been a revaluation. So this slide actually shows that calculation, and that on average, our tax base has increased 1.57%. Over the time period since the last revaluation. So next, it's really just to go through how the revenue neutral tax rate is calculated. And I just have some basic information here. It's the that average growth rate that we just saw how that was determined. Our current tax rate is 34 cents. The tax levy from this current year was $3,143,500. Next is the actual calculation. What would the tax levy be for this upcoming fiscal year if there was not a revaluation? So that's just taking our tax base, current tax base, times times the growth factor, then multiplied by the current tax rate of 34 cents. So that's saying that if we did not have a revaluation, we could expect a tax levy in this next fiscal year of about $3,192,860. That number is then divided by the new tax base to come up with the revenue neutral tax rate, which in this case is 25.58 cents. So it's actually a change in tax rate, a reduction of about 8.42 cents. So again, that revenue neutral tax rate is what would produce basically the same amount of revenue as the current rate, but adjusted because of the change in valuation. So I don't know if there's any questions on that. So next I just will go through the general fund revenue. It's budgeted for fiscal year 22, and I'm not going to comment on all the different things, just a couple things. You know, property taxes has always been about 50% of our revenue for the general fund. Sales tax is about 20%. Garbage and recycling fees about 8%. Paid parking, which, you know, we're estimated based on, using conservative estimates since it's a new program, but that's estimated at 5%. TDA funds also at 5%, and franchise and utility taxes at 4% of the budget. So those six revenue sources are about $6 million, or about 91% of the general fund balance. Also mentioned with the property tax, we just went through that revenue neutral tax calculation. What's being proposed for this budget, though, is 26.58 cents. Tax rate, which is a 1 cent increase over the revenue neutral tax rate. So that really would translate into an increase of about 3.9% in tax rate increase. We've also seen, I guess, that recently that the county, I don't have that information here, but they're projecting to be 5 cents greater than their revenue neutral tax rate, which actually comes out to almost 12% increase. So I don't have those numbers here. Again, it was just information that came out recently, but I'll just mention that at this point. So, because they go through the same process of determining revenue neutral. Some of the other categories on here, I think are self-explanatory. I'll just comment on other financing sources. That's actually loans that we take out from banks to pay for capital projects or buy large pieces of equipment. And I just wanted to show this. This is the impact of the revenue neutral, our proposed rate versus the revenue neutral tax rate. And as this is based on a home valued at $450,000, so as we see, it would be an annual increase of $45, and that $45 represents 3.9% increase. So finally, with the general fund revenue, I just wanted to show our percentage of revenue by major source, and I put this in here just to show how consistent we are from year to year. The property tax has always been the major source, and typically at least very close to 50%. Most of the other categories, the percentage of revenue stays very similar from year to year. You do see the impact of paid parking on here, which is a new program that just started in April. And then things like other revenue vary from year to year, primarily due to reimbursements we receive from FEMA in regard to hurricane damages. And then also that last category, other financing sources, are just really the amount of loans that we would need to take in any given year to purchase equipment. I don't know if anyone has any questions on general fund revenue. This next chart shows the breakdown of general fund expenses. And again, I'll just kind of highlight the top six, which are police at 25% of the budget, public works, streets and sanitation at 21%, fire department at 17%, debt service at 10%, administration at 5%, and lifeguards at 4%. So those six functions are about $5.5 million, and they are about 83% of the total budget. I believe most of the other categories are pretty self-explanatory. There's another category where the major parts are committee expenses and tax collection and community center expenses. And I'll just comment and say that this fund is where the majority of town services are paid for. You know, things, everything from public safety and garbage and trash collection to general maintenance, building inspection, parks and recreation, and just general administration. So it's where a lot of the things happen that aren't specific to some other fund. So this is kind of the catch-all, but the catch-all is the majority of the town operations. Also in here, I mentioned about the capital expenditures. There are some significant capital expenditures being proposed, replacement of vehicles and replacement of equipment. All of those are about just about $200,000 in total, and then also about $150,000 for street paving. I don't know if anyone has any questions on general fund expenses. So this also is a chart that shows over the last 3 years the percentage of general fund expenses by department. And again, relatively consistent. Some of the variations, though, are the amount of capital expenditures we have in any given year. Another thing that's happening this year is recycling expenses were always part of the administration department. They're being reclassified into the streets and sanitation department. So you see the impact of that. And again, like I said, the other differences are the amount of capital expenditures in any given year. So before we move on to the water and sewer fund, any questions on the general fund? So the water and sewer fund, kind of hit the highlights on this one. This budget is about 7% greater than the current year budget. One thing of note is no changes to water and sewer rates. The budget does include $585,000 for infrastructure projects and capital equipment purchases. And this fund also has debt service. In this case, it's about $420,600 a year. So this slide shows the general fund, water and sewer fund revenue by category. The major components are, as we would expect, water and sewer charges are about 83% of the revenue. Other items include tap and connection fees, which are really dependent on building activity. And there's also an amount in here for other financing, which is a proposed loan for the purchase of equipment. And there's also, you see, an appropriation of fund balance of $206,580. That's kind of a placeholder at the moment. Us, like every other municipality in the country, is receiving funds from the federal government, the American Rescue Plan. Once those funds are received, they'll be transferred in, part of them will be transferred into this water and sewer fund to be used for a capital project. Replacement of some sewer lines. The next chart shows comparison of water and sewer fund revenue. Again, very consistent, showing that this current year and next fiscal year be comparable in regard to water and sewer charges, since there are no fee increases. The appropriation of fund balance we've already spoken about, and other financing, again, can vary significantly based on the amount of capital projects and the need for bank financing to pay for those. So next is the water and sewer fund expenses. Again, as we'd expect, operations is the most significant part of this budget at 78%. administration and finance are both about 10% of the budget, and the remaining part legal and governing body each are 1% each. I mentioned before that this fund includes about $420,600 of debt service, and that's actually about 15% of the total budget. And the capital expenditures being proposed are about $585,000, and that's about $220,000 for equipment and about $360,000 for infrastructure projects. So next is just some comparative information for the three-year period. Again, most of the departments are very consistent. Operations varies based on the amount of system maintenance that may need to be done and also capital expenditures. So before we move on to the next fund, any questions about water and sewer? Okay, next is the stormwater fund. Proposed budget is about a little over 31.5% greater than the current year budget. This budget does include a proposed 50% increase to the monthly stormwater fees, which we'll talk about a little more in just a couple minutes. This proposal has $420,000 for capital expenditures. That's the both equipment purchases and infrastructure projects. And this fund has about $37,000 of debt service. So this chart shows the stormwater fund revenue by source. Monthly stormwater fees are about 59% of the fund's revenue, and that does include the 50% fee increase that I just previously mentioned, and we'll look at some information about that on the next slide. Stormwater building fees are made dependent on building activity. Other financing we've talked about with the other funds are bank loans. And this budget also has a small appropriation of fund balance to be used for some of the capital expenditures and just ongoing operations. So this shows the actual stormwater or proposed stormwater fee increase that for a residential unit, currently the monthly fee is $10. The proposal is to increase that to $15 per month. Commercial, the rates vary based on the size of the property, so they range anywhere from $6.22 to $101.15 per month. So this, applying the same 50% increase, those fees would increase anywhere from $9.33 to $151.73 per month. And again, the reason for proposing an increase to the stormwater fees is that really just the cost of ongoing system maintenance and then also to build reserves for infrastructure projects that are going to be needed in the near future. So next just shows comparative information for stormwater fund revenue. You can see the proposed 50% fee increase greatly increases the budget amount for fiscal year 22. Other revenue was significantly higher in fiscal year 20 because of reimbursements from FEMA for stormwater system damages. And then other financing, again, we spoke that there's a significant piece of equipment that needs to be purchased that
Are all reimbursements in?
I'm sorry?
Arlen, are all reimbursements in now?
Almost. Actually, we just were notified maybe Thursday of last week that our final Hurricane Florence amount was approved, that we should get in within the next 60 days. So that, I believe, is a little over $58,000. So that'll close out Hurricane Florence.
Okay.
We did receive everything at this point for Hurricane Dorian and then Isaias. I think we have two things that we're still waiting for. They're all submitted. It's just working through the pipeline. Okay. So.
All right.
So next is stormwater fund expenses. Kind of broke this down into like operational costs, debt service, and capital outlay. And for this upcoming year, you know, capital outlay becomes a significant part of the budget because of again the need for one or two infrastructure projects, and then also a purchase of a piece of equipment. And this shows comparative information for stormwater fund expenses. Again, some ups and downs, I think, within operations, and really the impact in particular 2020 was due to damage to the stormwater outfalls during a hurricane. So we had extra repair costs there. Debt service is going to correct that direction. It's gone down significantly as a project was paid off in 2020. And then again, capital outlay can vary significantly from year to year. So does anyone have any questions on the stormwater fund? So the last four funds, we'll just kind of run through very quickly. Power bill fund, this is what's considered restricted revenue, kind of that it's received from the state based on an allocation, based on the population and also a number of street miles within the town. It can only be used for street-related things, whether it's maintaining, repairing, constructing town-owned streets. So for this upcoming year, the estimate is that we'll receive about $61,000 from the state, a little bit of interest income, and then we're actually going to use a large portion of the fund balance, about $257,000, to pay for some additional street paving. We talked about that in the general fund. The other part of it is in this fund.
So the total amount of money we're going to spend on repair
is probably about roughly $420,000 to $425,000. And it really needed to be split up because of the Powell Bill Fund, which we would hope would be able to cover those kinds of things. There's not enough funding.
Yeah.
Next fund is the Federal Asset Forfeiture Fund. This is as the police department participates in investigations by various federal agencies. Based on the outcome of the investigations, we share in assets that are forfeited. The unique thing, this also is restricted money. It can only be used for police-related activities, but not to, in lieu of their normal operating budget. It has to be kind of unique things. So for this upcoming year, it's estimated use of about $25,000. Next is the Sewer Expansion Reserve Fund. This is a, as it says, reserve fund for future expansion, construction, repairs to the sewer system. The primary revenue source is system development fees charged for new construction. And the estimate for this upcoming year is $9,090. That includes the system development fees and interest income on fund investments. And then finally, there's the Beach Protection Fund. This was established back, I think, in 2014. Really to pay for anything beach-related. From the initial thought was if we need to pay any beach renourishment costs, but also things like beach access repairs, dune maintenance, dune plantings, etc. So that the actual budget for this is very low this year. It's about $400, which is really just the interest income on investments for the fund. We'll kind of reevaluate later in the budget near the end of the fiscal year whether there's funds available to transfer in from the general fund to kind of continue to build that fund balance. Right now we have about $380,000 in that fund. So I guess in conclusion, I'll just say that I think this budget proposal you know, supports the priorities of established by the council, also reflects your commitment to providing exceptional services to residents and visitors, and is just overall responsive to the needs of the town. And I just want to thank everybody sitting back here, department heads, plus other town employees who participated in developing the budget. It could be a long and tedious process. So I guess with that, I'll ask if anybody has any questions or any clarifications on anything.
No, not from my perspective. We're adding to the safety of the town, and we're preparing for the future, principally stormwater.
Correct.
So I think the teams did a good job.
Yeah, great job, Marlon. Great job, the department as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you all.
Calm down, all right.
Okay.
We need to set a public hearing. Mr. Mayor, I'll make a motion that we set a public hearing for the proposed budget for Monday, June 7th at 6 o'clock.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Okay.
All right. Okay, moving on to old business. Looks like we've taken care of all the old business. New business. 10.1, approved resolution for the regional hazard mitigation plan update. Alan.
It was changed. Sorry. So, we worked with New Hampshire County. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Cool. So, we worked with New Hampshire County on the Southeastern North Carolina Regional Hazard Mitigation Plan, so they agreed that we participate there. It's required to be approved every year, and then every 5 years it's renewed for the renewal cycle. But we do need to authorize this. If you look on the second page of this resolution, in yellow, it directs the emergency manager, which is currently me, to ensure that we are reviewing it annually and then every 5 years as specified in the plan. So, I'll be glad to read it if you need me to, or if someone else wants to read it, since it's probably a bad connection. I recommend council adopt this resolution for the annual regional hazard mitigation plan update.
Okay, can we have a motion on a resolution?
I'll be glad. Yeah, make a motion. We adopt the resolution R21-1, adoption of the Southeast North Carolina Regional Hazard Plan update.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. I'll sign it.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. Discussion of tide gauge. Commissioner Ellen.
Yes, Mayor. Again, at the Valet's meeting last month with Commissioner Oliver, Commissioner Whitley, and myself, we saw a presentation regarding a sensor called a tide gauge, which I brought tonight. Anybody wants to look at it? It has a solar panel at the top to keep the battery charged. It sends a signal from the lower little antenna to water, bounces back, reads it, and sends that through the internet to a website that monitors the height of water. You mount this. I gave a handout to the commissioners and staff. Somebody else wants to look at it. You can log into the internet site, or you can even get an app on your phone and have up-to-date height of water. Now, the three of us that were in the meeting discussed where this might be useful in the Curie Beach area. You can put it on the pier. You could also possibly, as we discussed, go put it on the riverside near where the ditches drain the stormwater. And as the river backs up and storms occur, and that flow comes back and pushes that water or doesn't allow the storm water to get out into the river, that might be useful information. This was developed through a lab at the University of Hawaii. There are about 200 of these in operation today along five states here in the Atlantic coast. They got funding for them with a grant such that the states that got these, they're about $500 a piece. If you were to just want one for your house, that's about $3,000. You just went online and ordered one. So we got a good, we have a good deal if you want to buy this. And if we think, as a council, as a town, we can have useful information from it.
Any questions? I think you're all at the same meeting.
Yeah.
Any views on this?
I think it's a good idea if we could install it somewhere. Just a conversation I had with Matsu about some other things, talking to them. They are beginning to have some concerns about shoreline erosion on their side of the river. And I think we may be impacted by that at some point, not necessarily perhaps during any of our terms up here, but down the road. And I think if we could begin to start to compile that data somehow, I think that would be beneficial over time. Because I do see that being, the as John mentioned, the pushback in storms and high tides, anything, if we're receiving rain, to push back into our ditch system to keep the water from flowing out. So I think that would be interesting to monitor over time to see how it impacts us.
Alan, your thoughts?
I agree if we can find a place to, if we have a secure place we can put it.
And secure may not be too easy. we could put it on the, asked to put it on the pier down there at Fort Fisher we discussed. The recreation area. Jimmy said they could build something to put in the river. I think between the ditches at Kay and the Henniker ditch would probably be the best. Or in talking with Ed Parvin about some other stuff with Matsu, we could put it, David, on that pipe that we paid partially for, the outflow pipe at the dredge pond up in Carolina Beach. That would still be on the north side of town where the majority of our ditches are.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking for the river. I was doing it somewhere on that.
So in general,
I mean, it would be good to know that we're having pushback, especially with the river's crest. Like you said, during some of the bigger storms, the impact of that to the stormwater system, for sure.
So then it sounds like everybody believes this is a good idea.
This was presented by a Dr. Nicole Helko, and she brought this to me near the end of the session. They sent me an invoice. I have paid for that, but I will donate this to the town for their use.
What's the ongoing cost, Sean? I know what the initial fee.
There's no monthly fee. It coordinates through the internet.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, John. I was just going to say, you must have that wire.
In the tube, it's basically a cell phone in the tube that's constantly transmitting data. It's PVC pipe, and there's basically the guts of a cell phone in there, powered by the solar panel, that will send that information back constantly.
And they pay a monthly fee?
What was that?
Pay a monthly fee?
They don't make
No, No, I'm sure they're using the data for something also, you know.
So essentially, okay. just pay for the device, and they will monitor the device and tell us what the status is.
So we can check it any way we want. And if we did co-locate it up in CB, I told Ed Parvin we would give them the information also, so they could, if they wanted to track anything, they would have access to that data also, try to be a good neighbor, you know.
And they could get their own for $500.
Okay, sounds like it's a good idea. We'll decide where to put it. John has already paid for it. I don't think that's quite the right thing to do here. So we have a motion to go ahead and get the unit and see where best to utilize.
Does that motion include reimbursing?
Yes, once we have a resolution, yeah.
Okay.
I mean a motion.
Okay.
Otherwise, no.
I make a motion we discuss the best placement to install the tide gauge, and at that time, Commissioner Allen would be reimbursed for the purchase for $500.
Second.
Motion and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. All right. Good thought, John.
Thank you
for sticking your neck out that way financially. That's a couple months' salary for you.
Well, they just never mentioned what they cost at any point.
$500, that's a big salary.
Well, that was never mentioned in her presentation before, what the cost of the sensor were.
Okay.
In John's defense,
it didn't say it cost $500.
All right. Discussion of town ordinance review with input from Building Inspector Batson and Police Chief Mike Bowden. Mr. Whitley.
All right, this is looking forward. We've almost finished with the 160D. We just have to approve it. Then we're going to get into the meat of the land use plan. In that time period, I've had conversations with Chief Bowden and John Batson. I'd like for them to go ahead and start reviewing town ordinances. We've mentioned this before. We have some perhaps archaic ordinances out there that could do with some updating. John said he could probably pick about half of them out, but it just could be something ongoing. Maybe even address correctly that thong law that's out there, in my opinion. But have them go ahead and do some work. Maybe have them come back in November. Let us know where they stand with any ordinances that either need to be updated, removed, changed, amended, whatever, so that, and at that point we will know where we are standing in the land use plan, because we'll be June to November, we'll be 5 months into the land use plan, and I'm thinking about the time and effort of our attorney in this. See where we stand, and then we can begin to, on the back burner, move forward with updating some of these ordinances that, as John stated, kind of cut and pasted in the 70s. You couldn't cut and paste in the 70s, though. But just get everything brought up to speed throughout the town.
Xerox.
Yeah.
Counselor?
Can I comment just briefly? The one thing I wanted to mention, I think that timeline is fine, and it made me think of two things. One, I don't know the council. I think council is aware, but Ms. Sanders, Ms. Chase, and I have as a priority item to review and probably rewrite to a significant extent town policies, quote policies, end quote. And that's something that we plan. Well, 160D Part 1 will be finished come June. There's going to be a cleanup session after that from top to bottom to correct all the citations to 160A and just to conform to style. That's part two. When the dust settles on that, staff intends to take up the policy rewrite. And the there was one other thing I was going to mention. One of the other things that was real interesting, going back to the 160D treatment of PZC's duties and responsibilities, there's quite a bit of language and responsibility in that section for PZC's involvement with the update of the comprehensive plan. Just wanted to mention that.
So I don't really think we need a motion, do we? Just more of a consensus with some direction. So.
Yeah, I think we can. I mean, the timeline, maybe they can come back and tell us what the timeline would be. But I think it's a smart thing to start to look at. Eliminating some of those...
Illegal to play softball in the streets of Curry Beach.
Yeah, eliminating some of them may not mean that there won't be others that need to be added.
Yeah.
Right? But, yeah.
It's a big project, and it'd be great for legal to rely on the input from building inspections and the chief. That would be a big help.
Okay. So, Chief, something you can do? Spare time?
I have some other work on, yes, sir.
All right. Okay. John?
I see ones that should be edited all the time. That's kind of where I was coming from, possibly picking out about half of them, but it's a working document. There's always things that need to be changed and updated as the situation arises. But yes, I'm going to start keeping a running list of things that I think should be looked at.
Okay. Can you guys put together somewhat of a schedule? By that, that would at least let the attorney know when he may have a chance to.
November sounded pretty good.
Well, and I said November because I figure paid parking ends in September. We'll address that potentially at our meeting in October. And then November, they could present. We know where we are with the land use plan, and we balance out Mr. Eldridge's time between land use plan and this, you know, as we see fit, or as he can accommodate, rather.
How does November sound, John?
I have some.
Okay. How about you, Chief?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. You said it. You got it.
Thank you.
Mayor updates? I don't think I have any. Commissioner items? Alan?
Nothing.
Joseph?
I spoke with DOT this week. They will be coming to fix the broken area that Mr. Ellen addressed on the shoulder heading south from the pipe there on Dow, and will be here next week to correct. And it's 100% their issue, they stated, to correct the issue at the pipe there that goes under Dow before the curve.
Okay. So. John? Okay.
Mayor, before Counselor? We get to Councilman Hagler, I have an update on one of his items. Councilman, I have learned a lot about 160D, but I don't have all of it memorized by any chance. But I did want to, I thought of something, I went back and looked at it, and I've confirmed something that'll interest you. The section that provides for appeals of administrative decisions to BOA expressly carves out stormwater regulation decisions. They don't go to BOA. So when I went into Chapter 9, I see that the provision for appealing a stormwater regulation decision goes to Town Council. So I think your concerns have been addressed both by the 160D carve-out in Chapter 9's provision for appealing to Council. What will have to be addressed is a reference, maybe some moving around, but we've got a reference that the appeal of stormwater regulation decisions to council needs to be quasi-judicial, but I'll take care of that prior to the special meeting where 160D will be acted on. But I want to let you know that.
Okay.
You still there?
Yes, sir. I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. David, did you have anything else?
Just a reminder to have the Hurricane Public Awareness Meeting this Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
So, I think they have been asked out, right, Mandy?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And based on what the council said, it will be open to the public in Town Hall Friday afternoon and Saturday morning.
Okay. All right. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
We all said yes.